Hey y'all, my name's Debbie. I'm an alcoholic and a dope fiend. And I'm wearing the crown just to show you that I do have royalty in my blood somewhere. I don't know where, but that's just my sick sense of humor. I've been sober since 5/23/02. For that, I'm truly grateful. And for a loving God that showed me the direction that, was so crucial and important to me. It's my responsibility as a recovering alcoholic and addict to read you a small portion of the big book, because what you hear me say is my opinion and my truth and my guidance. I will quote the big book, sort of, but it's what turned my life around. So, on page 58, it says, our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. This is going to be my truth and my story. First and foremost, I just have to tell you that being sober has been a bit awkward for me, because I used to be able to say, sorry, I acted so freaking crazy, but I was on drugs and drinking. Well, now I have to be like, sorry, I acted so freaking crazy because I am crazy. They took the drugs and the alcohol away, and I'm feeling much better because of that. But I still have weird perception sometimes. So let me tell you a little bit about me and qualify myself. I come from a family of 8 kids, with the strong arm being the guidance and direction. I am the second to the oldest of 8. My stepsister was, my mom divorced my dad and brought 4 more kids into the household with another man, and all of a sudden we have Cox's Army. My mother ran the house with a strict arm. And I rebelled, and I started drinking around 14, and I'd go babysit and I'd find the liquor above the stove. Does everybody hide it there or what? And I drink some of the liquor, and I'd have my boyfriends over or whatever, and then I'd fill that bottle back up with a little bit of water. Anybody ever do that? Or put some tea in there to keep the color going. I will tell you that I was very promiscuous. At the age of 16, I got pregnant with my first child, and being that my mother was more worried about the look of the family, immediately we went to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I had my first abortion. It was a horrible experience. My mom said, I'll get you on the pill. And I was like, no, I'll never do it again. My famous last words. Four months after that, I got pregnant again. And this time I decided I wanted to keep the child, and my parents provided me with a shotgun wedding. My boyfriend had gone off to the Army, and my parents called his CO and let him know that they had a minor child that was pregnant by their soldier. And the next thing I know, I'm wearing yellow, walking down the aisle, 6 months pregnant, and I have my first child before I even get out of high school. I did graduate midterm. That's one good thing I did. And I, baby in tow, I got to go live in Germany for about 15 months. I will tell you that promiscuity is a huge part of my story. I always sought validation. I also had the addiction of testosterone and seeking approval. Huge things in my story that I think a lot of us women go through. At 25, my husband got out of the service. Just smoked a little pot. When I was in Germany, I drank a little. My promiscuity was horrible. My husband was gone three out of the 4 weeks of the month. And during that time, I fooled around on him a lot. I drank a lot. One of my truths that I'm not really proud of is the fact that I would put my baby girl to sleep. She was about 5 or 6, 7, 8 months. Put her in her bed with a bottle. And then I would hitchhike to town and go party for the night and catch a cab back home, and usually brought somebody home with me. I'm not proud of that, but the fact that I left my baby by herself is a truth that my daughter knows. She's forgiven me for it. My God has forgiven me for it. And my daughter is my best friend today. For that, I'm truly graced by God's goodness. She and I changed roles as I began to use. She became the maternal role and I became the spoiled brat. What did that look like? Well, I divorced my husband, found another husband. Oh, I went to treatment in 1981 at a place called The Ranch, which is where you ladies are right now. But it didn't look anything like that. And it was a long barracks. The men were at one end, the women were at the other end, and the only thing separating us was a tech. And we would get in the druggy buggy and we'd go to meetings in town. And I will tell you this, that I picked up the big book and started to read it, and it said only about alcohol. Well, when I went to Europe, I didn't really care for the alcohol. I learned about smoking hash. When I came back to the States, I learned about pot. I'd have wine coolers periodically, but at the age of 26, I discovered at a job that there was this white powder that would allow me to stay up longer, that would allow me to get my housework done, get the supper cooked, clothes done, all that stuff. And this friend of mine said, come on out here. You look really tired. And I went out by his toolbox and he pulled the drawer open. There was a mirror there. And it was a line of white powder. And I'm like, I've never done this before. And he just tooted. And so I did it and oh my God, it was horrible. I think about it and it makes me sick to my stomach today. But I found my new best friend. I didn't tell my husband about it because, I didn't tell him about it for a couple of months, but then I went to work one day and this same person said, come here, I got something for you. And I went back there and he had a U100 syringe and this colored stuff in it. And he said, here, let me hit you with this. And I'm not glorifying my drug use, but that became my love for 5 years. That was at 25 when I had had enough. I kicked my husband out. I moved to Dallas. I changed locations because I knew if I moved to Dallas, there wouldn't be any dope there. But what I did learn is that I could drive that 35 corridor back and forth and I could go see my sugar daddy and he'd give me all the dope I needed. And then I'd go back to Dallas and I got customers up there. I will tell you that, I gave my daughter to my mother when she was 4 or 5 because my daughter wasn't as important to me as my drug use and my drinking. It was sad for my daughter, but I would get settled, get me an apartment, have my mom, I'd go down to Austin, pick my daughter up, move her back up to Dallas, get her enrolled in school for a couple of 3-5 months. And I couldn't pay the rent. The electricity gets shut off. And I'd call my mom and say, I need to put her on a plane. I have a new job. And my new job is working at, and this was a big lie, that I'm working at TI on the night shift and I can't keep her. The reality was, is I was going to the bars, doing wet t-shirt contests, selling dope, running the streets. You know how this disease is. It just, everything is secondary. I'm selfish and self-centered and it's all about me and I'm with the boys and I'm with the drugs and, it was a sick lifestyle to be leading. So I, in 1981, I had moved back to Austin. My sugar daddy moved me back to Austin and put me in a house and 3 blocks from my mom. My mom would help me with my daughter and I was a bartender and a dope dealer at a club in North Austin. And I learned how to bartend on roller skates. I know that's crazy, but it does happen and you get good tips. Plus I could drink as much as I wanted and I could party as much as I wanted. Now, was I making a lot of money? I was spending a lot of money on my dope and my habit. In 1981, I had a horrible car accident on Kramer Lane and, I'd been partying with a friend, a guy friend and a girlfriend. And we were coming back from Soap Creek Saloon after I'd seen Jerry Jeff Walker. and we hit a slick spot in the road and flipped the truck. The guy was driving, I was in the middle, and then my lady friend that was on the right side, they both went out the passenger door. The truck flipped. I landed half in the cab and half in the bed of the truck with the truck upside down. Now, these were in my country western days, and I had a cowboy hat on. That's the only thing that saved my life, because I'd thrown my arm up to cover my hat. The hat went off. I almost lost my arm. I have a scar on my arm that reminds me that was the first divine intervention from a power greater than myself that I didn't realize was telling me I needed to slow down. 3 months later, after not being able to lift a bottle, to pour drinks and not being able to work, I found myself bouncing from dope dealer to dope dealer to dope dealer trying to get drugs. I had my little girl in tow. After a 4-day binge, I remember walking because I didn't even have a car. And nobody would let me in their house. They'd had enough of me. And something told me that I needed to go get some help. I don't know what it was, and I think it was a subliminal message, but I walked into an Army recruiter's office, and I asked him to give me a ride to my aunt's house, which turned out to be one of my mom's best friends. And he took me there and he dropped me off. My first thought when I walked in there was I could get him to take me to the dope dealer's house. But then this other thought interfered and said, no, you need to get help. So I went to my mother's friend, one of her best friends, and I told her I needed help. Well, the next thing I know, I'm at Austin State Hospital. And I'm at intake, and they say, do you have an alcohol and drug problem? And I said, no, I just want to die. Anybody ever say that? Don't say it at a psych hospital. Okay. I ended up in a psych ward for 45 days. Let me back up for a second. My mom worked in rehab. My whole family worked at Austin State Hospital. My mom worked at rehab. I had a sister in food service. I had a brother in maintenance. I had a sister that worked at central office. I had a sister in medical records, a brother that worked in the lab. I mean, out of 10 family members, not counting me, there's 9, 7 of them worked there. And part of my treatment plan was that I couldn't see any of my family. So I was pretty much locked on a ward. And after 45 days and doing the Mellorill shuffle where you just my sister said she saw me walking in circles crying with no purpose. And I didn't even recognize her. I asked to not take any more meds. My first realization that I don't need drugs. And I found out that they had an alcohol and drug abuse treatment center at Austin State Hospital, and I wanted to be transferred over there. So keep in mind, I've had 45 days of no meth in my body, no pot, no alcohol. The only thing I've been doing is Mellorill. They take that away. I'm not getting my testosterone. And they put me on a unit where it's co-ed, men and women. And my first thing is that I'm sober now. I need to find me a future ex-husband. But to me, it was finding a husband, because I'm a woman and I need to be taken care of. So I hunted down the cutest, biggest guy. And within 4 months after going to REAP, Right Road Farm, we were married. Got the White House with the picket fence, got my kids back, got the family back, got a good state job, started school. Within 3 months, my husband at the time decided he was going to go shoot some meth. And the next thing I know, I've never seen paranoia the way it was. He would stalk me, hide in my garage. Oh my God, it was horrible. But I said, I don't need this, and sent him on his way. I divorced him. And I will tell you that it didn't take me very long. I think the marriage lasted a 6 months total. I enrolled in school and I was doing that and I wasn't going to meetings. I sponsored myself. I busied myself, but this disease centers in my mind and tells me I'm okay. And I've got this huge hole in my heart and I'm trying to fill it with testosterone, shopping, gambling, education, food, more money, and it's not getting full. So I seek out and, within 15 months of being dry and not working a 12-step program, but doing it myself, someone said, and I keep in mind, I didn't really have a drinking problem. I like drugs and pills and pot. Someone said 25-cent drinks for ladies. And I thought, I can entertain spending a dollar. And that was on Wednesday night. On Thursday night, I'm spending another dollar. Well, by then I'm spending $3 and $4 and, you know, you got to tip the bartender. And the next thing I know, within probably a month, I'm smoking dope. I got a needle in my arm and, I've lost my recovery. I'm recreationally using, no such thing. The disease picks up right where you left off. I stunted my growth again and, I managed to recreationally use for another, well, 25 years. It wasn't pretty. I found another future ex-husband. I helped him raise his two children and my daughter, and we lived in a house together. And, you know, a lot of people didn't know I was shooting dope. They thought I was just shooting dope. And however you do it, it distorts your thinking. It distorted my thinking. Let me just reiterate. It taught me some things about the hard knocks, living on the hard knocks. You know, I became homeless. I took my dog and myself in a truck and went everywhere couch surfing. It wasn't very pretty. In fact, on March 2002, excuse me, in 96, 97, my mom got real sick and, she had cancer. And you would think I would have some compassion and empathy for my mom, but I was just, you know, devastated. And when she passed, all I could think of was, who's going to take care of me now? Because my mom was a very good enabler. She'd bring me groceries. She'd pay my bills. And as soon as I got my check, she'd take my check. She'd bring me groceries and she'd charge me for my groceries. And she'd help me with my daughter. I mean, she did the very best that she could. And I used her and I abused her and I did not treat her any way that a daughter should treat her mother. Her passing was probably the hardest thing for me to acknowledge, but I know that she was tired of trying to get me sober and she had tried and tried and tried and tried and tried and tried some more. So, that was in 97, 98. I was a total ass at the service at my mother's house. I was a total ass. Who's going to take care of me now? Are we drama queen? Right here. 5 years later, my daughter has, found her a man in her life. They have a little boy. He is my favorite grandson. And my daughter decides to marry this man. And, so I get to go to the wedding and it's March of 2002. And my daughter's like, Mama, can you just promise not to do any dope on my wedding day? I said, oh, Heather, don't worry. Don't worry. I will be there the day before, spend the night with you and we'll start your wedding day together. Well, we are full of broken promises, words and things that we can't keep. And I managed to get to her house about 4 o'clock in the morning after I'd done my drinking at the bar. It was a horrible experience, for her. Me, I didn't even care about it. You know, it's just, I'm here. You just need to take it for that. I tried not to make the wedding about me. It's her day. It was beautiful. And about 3 weeks after her wedding, she called me and she said, Mom, I can't have you in my life anymore. I can't watch you kill yourself. I have to let you go. I have my family now. And being the person that has my feelings down in my boot, I was like, well, that's fine with me. Go do some more dope. Go drink some more recreationally. And so what? Very wrong. Because on May 8th of 2002, I was coming home from the bar where I had learned to be the bartender and the dope dealer. I worked at the bar one day out of the week, so I'd get my drinks half price, and the rest of the time I would deal at the bar and drink, and I'd run a tab, and my paycheck would cover the drinking. I want to get to the solution, but what happened was I ended up getting busted on 5-8 of 02 in Williamson County. I call that my divine intervention. It was God sending me a message. Let me qualify myself, because this is what I looked like. Now, if you can look at that person, they look dead. They look very hollow. I was miserable. And once again, this person was already dead. I knew that I had an attorney. I knew that I was up shit creek without a paddle. I knew that the only number I could remember was my daughter's. And they busted me about 3 o'clock in the morning. And they asked me all kinds of questions, and they wanted me to roll. And I was like, no, no. And they took me to Williamson County Jail and started questioning me, and finally I wouldn't roll, so they put me in the holding cell, and all I could think of was, who can I call? And the only person's number that I could come up with was my baby girl. And keep in mind, she's the mama role now, and I'm the spoiled brat. My daughter and her husband and child had moved to Bastrop. She would get up super early in the morning and be out the house by 6 o'clock. This particular morning, it was a Friday, and I remember calling about 3 minutes after six, praying, oh God, please let her answer the phone, please let her answer the phone. And she had forgotten something and had to go back in the house. And this is when there was landlines, okay? And she heard the phone and she answered it. And of course, when you get a call from Williamson County or any jail, you have a total of how many seconds? Maybe 12. So it was like, Heather, it's your mom. Don't hang up. Not, good morning. How are you? What's going on? It's your mom. Selfish and self-centered. That's my disease. She accepted the call, and it was, Mom, what are you doing? What's going on? I said, I'm in Williamson County. I need you to go to the house. I've got money there. I need you to get a hold of my attorney, and da-da-da-da-da. She said, Mom, stop. What's going on? Then I had to explain what had happened. Instead of me being the kid that I'd been, I all of a sudden jumped into the mother role and started telling her what to do. And she was like, oh, Jesus, mother. I'm really grateful for my daughter, because she did follow instructions. And by 5 o'clock that day, I got out. Now, I will tell you that you ladies that are familiar with designer bags, my daughter had given me a Dooney Burke backpack. And it's this big, I mean, it's big, and you put it on your back. And anyway, I had my makeup in there. I had my bills in there. I mean, there was so much shit in there that the jailers kept moving it down the desk because no one wanted to catalog all the shit that was in it and my stuff. And when they searched my purse, they didn't find all my dope. And when I finally got out, and some friends of mine, my frequent users, came to pick me up, they didn't find 5 grams of my meth. And I knew that I needed to stop doing it. And so I instantly turned around and sold it to them, called my boss. My boss said, I don't have a job anymore. And then I began to go into depression. And I went home. I gave up the meth, smoked cigarettes, smoked pot. Would have my coffee with some Kahlua. I'd drink my White Russian, and then I'd sleep as much as possible because I've taken Xanax too, and I went through withdrawal on my own. And then after 2 weeks of that, I called my daughter and I said, "I need help. I can't do this by myself." And that's when I went to Austin Recovery. Austin Recovery showed me an avenue that I never thought that I would be able to see. And what did that look like? I walked in with my daughter in tow, and she said, "My mom's here. She needs some help. She needs to get into treatment. You know, I'm so codependent. I got to have somebody speak for me." And they said, "Okay, well, we'll give you a date," which was 8 days later. And I'm like, "Don't you know who I am?" They said, "We don't have a bed for you." And that bed had to be state funded because I didn't have money for it. So anyway, long story short, 8 days later, after going there every day, suiting up, finally by myself, they tell me, "We've got a bed for you." And I'm living in Taylor and I've got all my stuff in the car, but I let them know I've got to go to Taylor to get my clothes and stuff because I don't have them in the car. And I drove around in Cross Park, smoking another joint, hot boxing that sucker, because I knew for 30 days I wasn't going to be able to smoke. And then, I don't know if y'all smoke pot, but wherever I went, I had perfume, and I would get rid of the smell, so I thought. And when I walked into Austin Recovery on 5/22 of 2002, I didn't think they could smell the pot on me. And I didn't put pot on my intake. And I went through the program. And after being there for 14 days, Miss Carolyn, God love her, I think I was one of her first clients. She let me just live my little fantasy. And after being there about 2 weeks, I finally went to her after going to one of those classes. And was, swear to God, they were talking about me in that meeting. And I went to her and she gave me a koosh ball and said, "Don't leave. Just if you start feeling squirrely, squeeze that koosh ball." The koosh ball was my very first higher power. It kept me in the rooms of AR. Moving forward, I did 32 days at Austin Recovery. I found me a sponsor, a lady that came into the rooms playing a guitar, singing about recovering addicts and alcoholics, talking solution from a book that looked like this. This is my big book, and yes, it's in lots of pieces because I used the son of a gun. And she told me what was I willing to do, and I said, and I just said, whatever it takes. So she made a few things with me, agreements, and that was that I wouldn't get into a relationship for at least a year. And she promised to take me through the steps within 30 days. She got me through the steps. Within 4 or 5 months, they re-indicted me on that arrest warrant from a Class B felony to a Class A felony, and then they issued a warrant for my arrest, and the next thing I know, I am in friggin' Williamson County. And, you know, I've learned that you're treated a little different when you go in and say, "I want to die." Yeah, don't do that in jail either, because you end up in a padded cell with very little clothes on, and for a little while they observe you. I did 31 days at Williamson County, and when I went before the judge, he hit that gavel and he said, "How do you plead?" And I said, "Guilty." And he said, "I'm sentencing you to 10 years TDC time." And there was a long pause, and then he hesitated and finally said, "But I understand you're working a program and you're going to meetings, and I'm going to give you the opportunity to do 10 years probation. But if you get out there and you use, you go do the straight 10 years. So now you know where I've been and what's happened and how I got here. Let me tell you about these steps. Let's get to solution, because that's the part I like. Step one for me was to surrender to my ultimate truth, to my core. Surrender to be a winner. That I'm an addict to my core. I can't drink a beer. I can't have a shot of anything. I can't smoke a joint. I can't do a line. because if I do, I'm right back in hell. Alcohol and drugs changed the way I felt. I had to walk through those feelings and be raw. Step two, that was a crucial one for me. I had to do a step one solid so my foundation would be without holes in it. It talks about it in the book. On page 45 in the big book, it tells us lack of power. That's our dilemma. We had to find a power greater than ourselves by which we could live. It had to be a power greater than ourselves. And we found on page 46 that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, which means I just had to be willing to believe. And then this is we agnostics, in case you want to look it up and read it yourself. On page 47, it says, do I now believe or am I willing to believe that there is a power greater than myself? Well, yes, there is a power greater than myself. I just had to be willing to believe. When I got to step three, they started talking about God and we agnostics and a higher power. And it was like God either is or he isn't. That was my choice. And I was raised by a Catholic in a Catholic family, and the God I knew was punishing. I was going to purgatory because I could never tell the truth. But then my sponsor said, why don't you come up with your own concept of God or your own concept of a higher power? So what I learned to do was write a Craigslist want ad for the power greater than myself that I wanted. Honest, realistic, loving, kind, teaching with a sense of humor, teach me patience, be a teacher. And I showed it to my sponsor and she said, that's going to be your higher power. What are you going to call it? And I call him God. Step four, oh Lord have mercy. Step four is a personal inventory that we do on ourselves. And let me explain to you, 1 through 3 is about getting right with your higher power. That is so crucial. You got to find a higher power, because I can't live by human aid. My mother couldn't keep me sober. My husband couldn't keep me sober. I couldn't keep me sober. So that meant I had to dig deep and find something greater than myself. So on step four, it's about sharing the secrets. People, places, sexual behavior, exes on paper. Writing it out. It's a painful experience. And then step five is when I go and share that with my sponsor. The first time I went with my four step to my sponsor to do the fifth step, I just said, I don't bring the paperwork. I got it all in my head. I don't need to bring you the writing. And the reality behind it, I didn't want her to know all my little secrets. Nobody was going to know those. So I spent about 2 hours with her, and she says, okay, now you need to go sit, do 6 and 7, which is about your character defects and your shortcomings. And the next thing I know, I'm freaking out because I wasn't honest. And I called her back within 3 hours and I said, sponsor, I wasn't completely honest. Can I have a do-over? And Thursday, that's what I did. That was Sunday. Thursday, I went back to her house and I cried like a baby, and she listened to me. And some of those little secrets that I had kept were the same things that she had done. So it made it okay. Step six is about finding out my defects of character, and I had to be willing to hear what she said, and accept it. And also defects and assets side by side. I have good things and I have bad things about myself. Step seven is about humility. That's about the shortcomings. Some of my shortcomings used to be gossip, judgment, disrespecting others. That's just to name a few. But once I was aware of what those shortcomings and my character defects were, I began to be able to work on them. Step eight, I had to take my list of people that I had caused harm to. And let me go back to 4, 5, 6, and 7. That's about getting right with your higher power and yourself. I had to be able to look at myself. You know, the common denominator to all those resentments I had was me. damn, I didn't want to look at my shit. My sponsor was like, well, let me just tell you. And I was like, I don't want to hear it. But that was the best thing she could have done for me. The principle behind step 7 is humility. The principle behind step 8, I believe, is love. If I'm not mistaken. And that was when I would present my people that I needed to make amends to and go over the list with her, and she would tell me yay or nay. And one of them was the bartender, the guy that owned the bar. One of them was the dope dealer. No, you don't go there. No, you don't do that. And step 9 is when you actually go and do those amends. It's called forgiveness. It's about me cleaning my side of the street. It's none of my business what that other person's doing or did. It's about, what am I willing to do? And what did that look like? Well, they presented themselves when I least expected them. But I was willing to step up and do that. Step 9 is about forgiveness. Step 10, well, that's the personal inventory that we're supposed to do every day. And that's called daily maintenance. Step 10 is something that it's referenced in the big book. It's about doing all those little things to find out, did I cause harm to somebody? Was I ugly? Did I judge somebody? Just briefly. Step 11 is that prayer and meditation that I do every day. I pray to God and I meditate for his answer to me. Praying is when you talk to God. Meditation is when you get quiet and listen. And my favorite step of all of them is step 12, service, which is what I get to do tonight. I'm sharing my experience, strength, and hope. I sponsor ladies. I used to run sober houses for women for 8 years. You know, some of the life events that did happen to me that I think are crucial and important is that at 2 years sober, I didn't have a place to live, and I wanted to start a sober house, and I was working at the NA24 and was making 5 1/4 an hour. And I sat in there one morning and I said, I wonder what it takes to start a sober house. And there was an old man in there and he said, when do you want to move in? And I was like, I can't make that decision. I need to call my sponsor, because that's how we roll. We call our sponsor when we're making life changing experiences. And so I ran sober houses for 8 years. At 5 years sober, I was diagnosed with Hep C. I went through the Hep C treatments. Today, I'm Hep C free. During that Hep C treatment, wrapping it up, my sister was murdered. I thought it was going to be the death of me, but it was ironic. No, it wasn't a coincidence. God had me going to a women's retreat the very next day. And I went to that women's retreat, and those women, 125 of them, just loved me and let me be and let me cry and let me rock. And they brought me food and they made sure I was okay. And the next week I got to go and be with my family and walk through that, being the stronger one. I started a new job in 2005 and it went till 2019, and I worked for an attorney in downtown Austin. He took very good care of me. In 2019, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. I was able to walk through that having health insurance. And today I am cancer free. I don't have the big boobies that I used to have. I'm cancer free. That's the blessings of this. And what am I doing now? Well, I went to work in a treatment center for a little while and they fired me because of COVID. I've been able to draw unemployment since June 16th of 2020. God's been good to me. It's allowed me time to sponsor and work with women, and I still live in the same place that I've been in for the last 8 years. Life is good. If I don't share anything else with you, just know that this program is not the easier, softer way. It takes some work. It takes some diligence. It's how free do you want to be? You know, I trudge. I do my damnedest. I have days with depression. But I know that in my heart, when I did that third step prayer with my sponsor, that I was willing to give my life, my actions, my thoughts to my higher power. I can't have faith and fear at the same time. It's one or the other. faith is what I live by. I have been very graced. There's people in my court that have been with me since my daughter was 4, 5. They're my biggest cheerleaders. I have sponsees all over the place. There's a lot of them here tonight. I have a home group. My home group is Heart and Soul Sisters of Cocaine Anonymous. We meet on Wednesday nights from 6:15 to 7:15, Zoom. I've been able to go to 5 real meetings in the last year. The rest of them have been Zoom. And I will tell you that today I picked up my chip for 18 years in 2020 today. So you can do this. You can do this. There's nothing holding you back. But if you pick up and use, choices go away. So thank you, Chris, for having me. It's been a pleasure to see all you beautiful faces. Again, miracles, miracles, miracles. Had I any idea I was going to live this long, I'd have taken better care of this body. But that's okay. I'm alive. I'm 65, and I'm enjoying my life. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Debbie.
Thanks, Debbie. It was great.
Awesome, Debbie. Thank you.
Thank you, Debbie, for your story. It was really empowering, by the way.
Thanks, Debbie.
All these miracles.